All right. November 6, 2024, 3 o'clock p.m. at Phil Albrecht's hearing examiner for Kitsap County, back on the record for PLN 22-02653, the Arborwood Tabor appeal. We are in the applicant's phase of presentation. They're bringing up Chris Wright for testimony. So I'll just hand it over to us. Is Chris Wright there? Is he on the panel yet?
Give me 1 second. I'm moving him over right now.
Okay, Mr. Wright, let's see, there he is. All right, let me swear you in. Just raise your right hand. You swear affirm to tell the truth, nothing but the truth in this proceeding?
I do.
Okay, all right, go ahead, Ms. Cuyas.
Thank you. And is my audio working? I kept the same sound. Okay, thank you. Mr. Wright, what is your current occupation?
I am the president of Radke Associates Soil and Wetland Scientist.
Thank you. And Ms. Koski, if we could please pull up exhibit B15. Thank you. And if we could just zoom out a tad, that would be great. And Mr. Wright, have you seen this document before?
Yes, I have.
What is it?
It's my resume.
And is this a current version of your resume?
I believe it is, yes.
Can you describe your post-high school education, please?
Sure. I hold a Bachelor of Science from the University of Arizona.
And do you have any certifications or licenses in your field?
I do. I'm a certified wetland delineator by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. I'm a certified wetland specialist in Pierce County. I'm a certified wetland scientist in the city of Bainbridge Island, Washington.
During the course of your career, have you participated in any professional trainings?
I have numerous professional trainings.
Can you describe a few of those, please?
Sure. I've been through the Corps of Engineers training on the regional supplements for both the Westerns, Mountains, Valleys, and Coasts, as well as the Arid West. I've been through the Washington Department of Ecology's training for ordinary high watermark determination. I've been through the Washington Department of Ecology's training for using the wetland rating system, both for Western Washington and Eastern Washington.
And apologies if I missed you mentioning this. How long have you been with Radke?
I've been with Radke Associates now for almost 30 years.
And do you have any professional experience prior to beginning at Radke?
I do. I've previously worked at another consulting firm for about 6 years. And then prior to that, I worked for the United States Department of Agriculture Forest Service.
As part of your professional experience, can you describe some of the type of work that you do typically or on a day-to-day basis?
Sure. Now is I do a lot of admin work, but prior to that, I did was responsible for delineations of wetlands on project sites, for working with the developers and the engineers and the geotechnicals folks in order to develop appropriate mitigations for sites, whether that be through minimizing impacts or through avoiding impacts or developing compensatory mitigation plans for those. Evaluating wetlands, evaluating streams, determining what habitats were important, and taking the projects through the permitting process at the local, state, and federal levels.
Can you describe some of the projects or the types of projects that you've worked on throughout your career?
Sure. Again, been with Radke Associates for nearly 30 years now. Our bread and butter has always been residential developments, particularly big master plan development communities, Redmond Ridge, Snoqualmie Ridge, Northwest Landing.
And I'm going to ask about your experiences with wetland analyses and wetland mitigation plans. But before we get into that, can you describe what the difference is between a wetland analysis and a wetland mitigation plan?
Sure. A wetland analysis is the determination of the categorization of wetlands. Starts with a delineation, identifying where a wetland is in the landscape, marking the edges of it, then running it through the rating system to determine the classification of that wetland relative to the requirements of the state of Washington. Once a project has been proposed that has the potential to negatively affect wetlands, then the requirement is that those negative impacts be compensated for through the development of a mitigation plan. Mitigation plans involve evaluating where the sensitive and the most affected functions of that wetland are and coming up with a plan to compensate for the potential loss of those functions resulting from the proposed development.
Approximately how many wetland analyses have you worked on throughout your career?
Hundreds, if not a thousand.
Were any of those prepared for development projects in Washington?
The majority of them, yes.
Were any of those for projects in Kitsap County?
Yes.
Okay.
Dozen or so projects in Kitsap County.
And approximately how many wetland mitigation plans have you worked on throughout your career?
Oh, again, that's a big number. Somewhere, certainly more than 100 different wetland mitigation plans.
Were any of those for projects in Washington?
Again, the majority of them in the state of Washington.
And any in Kitsap County?
Yes, we have developed mitigation plans for impacts in Kitsap County.
Have you testified as an expert witness before?
I have
Approximately how many times?
dozens of times.
What was the field of expertise that you were found qualified to testify on?
I am recognized as an expert in wetland science, in vegetation composition, and as soil science.
I'd like to move to admit Mr. Wright as an expert in wetland analyses and wetland mitigation.
Okay. I mean, I don't think we need to be that formal in this
Okay.
proceeding, but Mr. Telgen, do you have any objections over that, or do you want to ask any questions?
No, I think the standard is just whether it'd be helpful to the trier of fact, which is you, sir.
So, yeah, you see, I mean, yeah, I'd certainly recognize him as an expert in the field. Anyway, go ahead.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Wright, are you familiar with the Arborwood development that's at issue in this limited remand?
I am.
And how so?
Again, Radke Associates originally evaluated the property that's now known as Arborwood back in the 1990s. We were then asked to, after it had been about 10 years since we had previously worked on the site, we were asked to reevaluate the site, produce a document, wetland delineation report for the site that was used for moving forward with permitting of that. Our report was produced in 2007, and I was the primary author of that report.
And when did you first start working on the project?
I think the first time I set foot on this property was around 1998.
And are you still working on the Arborwood development?
No. Radke Associates hasn't been actively engaged in this project since around 2018.
Have you had any involvement with the development after 2018?
Again, I participated in the first CABR appeal hearing about a year ago, and that we produced a couple of technical memos regarding the difference in the wetlands as identified in ELS from what we had originally prepared, again, more than 15 years previously.
And what was your involvement in the first CABR?
Again, I believe that our wetland report was used as the basis for that CABR.
Um, So after the first caver was remanded, there was the preparation of a supplemental critical areas report that was submitted to the county. Did you provide any support for the preparation of that document?
No, we did not.
Have you reviewed the supplemental critical areas report?
I have not.
Have you reviewed the mitigation plans that are proposed in other critical areas reports that have been prepared for this portion of Arborwood?
Again, I reviewed the mitigation plans that were extant prior to the first appeal hearing about a year ago, but I haven't looked at any of documentation since then.
What is the purpose of a wetland buffer?
Wetland buffers are designed to protect the functions of the wetland itself. They are to provide a zone of area that should prevent or at least limit intrusions into the sensitive area of the wetland, that the buffer provides wildlife habitat for species that exist both in wetlands and in uplands. It provides a cleansing of any water that might flow through the buffer before it reaches the wetland, and it also provides a catchment area around the wetland that can provide some of the hydrologic support to the wetland.
How is the size of a wetland buffer determined?
In the state of Washington, wetland buffers width is determined based on the classification of the wetland. Is that again, the wetland rating system places wetlands into one of four categories. Category one being the highest value, most sensitive wetlands, category four being the least sensitive. The buffer width is then predicated on the classification of the wetland, and in many cases, based on the habitat score that that wetland also provides.
Why is a wetland categorized?
Different wetlands have different levels of sensitivity, and that by categorizing them, that allows the decision makers a better opportunity to understand how important a wetland might be within the landscape that it occurs.
Can you describe the wetland categorization process?
Sure. Again, it starts with delineating a wetland and identifying where the wetland is in the landscape. And then there's I think it's about 8-page questionnaire that the Department of Ecology has developed, which you answer questions regarding that particular wetland, and that each one of those answers provides a score. And then the summation of the scores from each one of those questions allows you to classify it into one of four categories, as I described before. Those that score the most points get category one status, those with the least get category four.
Are the same buffer widths used in every Washington jurisdiction?
No. Different jurisdictions have different buffer requirements.
Is Kitsap County's standard for determining the width of a buffer consistent with other jurisdictions throughout the state of Washington?
Yeah, they're very consistent with other jurisdictions within Western Washington.
Did you hear Dr. Cook's testimony this morning?
I did.
And did you hear her testimony regarding the 2013 Washington Department of Ecology update on wetland buffers, the State of Science report?
I did.
And are you familiar with that 2013 report?
I am.
And can you pronounce the author's name of that report? Is it Kru
T Tom Hruby.
Ruby. Okay, thank you.
Hungarian.
So Dr. Cook discussed that the Ruby report recommends buffer widths of a minimum of 300 feet to maintain wetland functions. Can you speak to your understanding about the recommendation for wider buffer widths that's included in the Ruby report or otherwise?
Sure. Again, there's the three different functions of buffers that are identified within that document. There is the function of water quality improvement, hydrologic support, and providing habitat, wildlife habitat. Those minimum 300-foot buffer recommendations are very specific to the wildlife habitat functions of wetlands. Is that, again, in fact, 300 feet might be too narrow for some particular wildlife species. But overall, the other functions are considered to be much smaller than 300 feet. In fact, for the water quality functions, the document quite clearly states that buffers as narrow as 16 feet can provide water quality functions. Pretty much lands on any buffer that's at least 100 feet wide can provide water quality functions.
I believe Dr. Cook also testified that wider buffer widths are particularly important for slope wetlands. Do you recall that testimony?
I do.
And do you agree with her opinion on that?
I really don't. Is that the buffer widths are not predicated on whether the wetland is a slope or a riverine or a depressional wetland, is that it's mostly based on the classification and the habitat value of that wetland.
Are you familiar with the terms permanent and temporary impacts in the context of wetlands and wetland buffers?
I am.
What is a permanent impact?
A permanent impact is the total loss of function, whether that be the loss of the wetland or a total loss of the wetland buffer area.
What is a temporary impact?
Temporary impacts are those impacts that, while the function might be lost or degraded for a period of time, is that that function can be restored through mitigation or natural processes.
And how do you know that that is what those terms mean, that that's what a permanent impact is and that's what a temporary impact is?
Well, those are the standards by which the agencies address temporary versus permanent impacts in the state of Washington.
And which agencies are you referring to?
The Department of Ecology goes into great explanation of those, and some of the other local jurisdictions also have definitions of temporary and permanent impacts.
Is it possible to have an impact to a wetland buffer but not have an impact to a wetland?
Absolutely.
And can you describe a situation where that might occur?
Sure. Again, if you have a buffer that's 100 feet wide and that you've lost 5 feet of the outer edge of that buffer, however, it's been mitigated so that you're not directing additional stormwater to the wetland, you're not there's no pollutant loading that's coming from that, is that it is a loss of wetland buffer, but that there's no impact to the wetland itself, and so no impact to wetland function.
If there is a temporary impact to a wetland buffer, will there necessarily be an adverse impact to a wetland?
No.
Why not?
Again, is that the different functions that are being buffered, protected by that, have differing levels of sensitivity. And so that a temporary impact to a buffer that is clearing the vegetation for the purposes of constructing something, that vegetation can be reestablished there, and that the wetland, for lack of a better term, would not notice that the for some brief period of time that there was no vegetation in the outer portion of that buffer.
Generally speaking, excuse me, how are temporary impacts to wetland buffers mitigated?
For the most part, particularly temporary short-term impacts are mitigated through reestablishment of vegetation within the impacted area. Development of a planting plan, a buffer mitigation plan that's reviewed and approved by the agency having jurisdiction, and then that mitigation plan is implemented and then monitored for a period of time afterwards to make sure that it is successful.
Is mitigation for impacts to wetland buffers generally successful?
Again, you don't get sign off from the agency having jurisdiction until such time as that buffer mitigation has been deemed to be successful. That's the purpose of the monitoring of this of these restoration activities afterwards, and the requirement to submit annual reports to the agency so that they can review and determine whether or not the performance standards established within the original mitigation plan are being met.
Examiner Ulbrechts asked Dr. Cook about temporary impacts to adjacent wetlands when there is a proposed road fill for a project. Do you recall that question?
I do.
And Dr. Cook described hydrogeological concerns and said that there are ways to mitigate more permanent design that allow for infiltration around, through, or under fill. Do you recall that
I do.
portion? And do you agree with that statement?
Yes, I do very much so.
Have you been involved in projects similar to Arborwood, where a slope wetland is adjacent to regraded slopes, and then there that requires additional fill in wetland buffers?
Yes, I have several projects that have been very, very similar to this.
And have you seen those impacts be successfully mitigated?
Yes, very much successfully mitigated. I think of a project that we worked on, Snoqualmie Ridge in the eastern portion of King County, and that again, a big roadway went through, and that there were slope wetlands that were down below, down gradient of where this road was, and that we were able to successfully construct the road to rehabilitate the buffer and to maintain the wetlands below. There was a requirement in that particular jurisdiction for 10 years of monitoring of the not just the buffer areas, but the wetlands themselves to determine if there was any impact to them. And at the end of that 10 years, we found no detrimental impact to any of the wetlands that were downslope of the road.
So, in other projects besides Snoqualmie Ridge, or Snoqualmie Ridge, if you'd like to refer back to that one, how did you propose those types of impacts be mitigated?
Again, working with the engineers and the geotechs and all of that to make sure that the design was minimized to the point practicable, and to make sure that adequate hydrology was still going to be transmitted through this barrier or through the road to maintain hydrology within the wetland. And then we, of course, developed the planting plans for any required revegetation within the buffer of the wetland.
At the end of the mitigation period, what was the outcome?
Again, the successful in again, the agencies will not sign off and say your project is complete until you can demonstrate you've had a successful mitigation.
And did that mitigation provide equal or better buffer function?
Oh yes, in fact, in most cases when we do this type of thing is that the buffer function is improved over what the existing condition was, or what the mere application of standard buffer widths would have provided to the wetland.
What happens if a buffer mitigation plan does not work?
Again, the requirement for annual monitoring, and if you find that you're having plants dying or that you've got erosive forces in that contingency measures are implemented in order to bring the buffer mitigation into compliance with the performance standards that are anticipated for that were approved by the agency. So again, annual monitoring, in some cases more than annual monitoring, but the monitoring determines whether or not the performance standards are being met. And if the performance standards aren't being met, contingency measures are implemented in order to bring it into compliance so that the buffer mitigation can be successful.
And Ms. Kosky, if we could please pull up Exhibit A90. Thank you. Mr. Wright, this is the exhibit that Dr. Cook described in her testimony. Do you recall that portion of the testimony?
I do.
So this table outlines her assessment of the 6 Ruby factors, her opinion on the relevance of each parameter, and the timeline it takes to restore each factor after it's been disturbed. So I'd like to walk through each of these with you. So for the first factor, which is decreased buffer widths, do you agree with Dr. Cook's description about the nature of the impact to slope wetlands when there are decreased buffer widths?
Yeah, I mean, a reduction in the area of buffer is certainly going to have an impact on the habitat function, on the water quality functions, and the hydrologic functions. Whether or not that's significant is up for debate. You know, it's a case-by-case basis on those. But yes, if you have less buffer, then you have less area to provide those functions.
And in the far right column on this table, it says that is permanent. Do you agree with her assessment about the timeline for whether the impact would be permanent relative to slope wetlands?
Again, no. The impact occurs, and that there are mitigations that can be implemented that would restore those functions. There is the possibility of enhancing existing buffers in order to improve those functions that they're providing, so that there is no permanent loss of function. There would be a permanent loss of area, but that area and function are not the same thing.
And on the second factor, increased slope, do you agree with Dr. Cook's description about the nature of the impact to slope wetlands?
Yes, an increased slope would increase the speed and volume of water running off of that slope. And again, faster moving water carries more sediment, so it has impacts on water quality functions, and the timing of the water reaching the wetland would have an impact on hydrologic functions. Well, again, whether or not those are significant changes is entirely based on a case-by-case basis.
Are you aware of whether that impact can be mitigated?
Absolutely can be mitigated, is that speed of the water moving down the slope can be ameliorated through the establishment of water bars, through the placement of logs perpendicular to the slope. There are many things that can allow the water to move more slowly down that slope so as to replace those water quality functions that were affected by the increase in the slope.
And you might have just touched on this with your answer, but Dr. Cook describes that as a permanent impact. Do you agree with her assessment of the timeline of that impact for slope wetlands?
Well, again, the slope will always be increased, but that doesn't mean that the function has a permanent loss of that function. Mitigation can be implemented that would allow for that function to be restored even on a steeper slope.
And on to the third factor, loss of surface roughness. Do you agree with Dr. Cook's description about the nature of that impact to slope wetlands?
Yes. I mean, again, if you remove all of the vegetation and you grade something, you know, pool table smooth, then you're losing that surface roughness, and you're resulting in very similar impacts as just by increasing the slope. Again, these are not impacts that cannot be mitigated because, again, the that surface roughness can be reestablished through many of the same types of activities that described for the increased slope, is that replanting the vegetation, placing cross logs across the slope, water barring, many things that can allow for the water to be slowed as it moves across that surface and even detained in micro depressions.
Do you agree with Dr. Cook's assessment that it would take decades to decades for that impact for slope wetlands to be restored?
Again, without mitigation, yes. To reaccumulate the duff would take a long time. But again, in most jurisdictions, that isn't an allowed practice, is that there's a requirement to restore those functions within the buffer through the mitigation plan, through planting, through incorporation of compost, through barking, mulching, ground surfaces, all of these things that would replicate the lost function that was there.
And on the fourth factor, soil infiltration and removal of upper soil horizons, including interflow, do you agree with Dr. Cook's description about the nature of that impact to slope wetlands?
Sure. I mean, if you go through and you remove all of the upper soil layers and do nothing to mitigate for it, you're losing that those complex ecological systems that are within that soil. And that, however, that doesn't mean that those can't be mitigated through. In my personal experience, anytime that we've had degrade within a buffer that we are going to restore, is that we take those upper soil horizons and we stockpile them off to the side, that they're graded, removed until the desired grades are reached. And then that soil is brought back in, respread over that surface, and used as a planting medium so that those exact same ecological systems, that those fungi, the bacteria that were within that soil there prior to the construction, are replaced there and then replanted with new plants to mitigate for the temporal loss of those functions during the time that it was graded.
And Dr. Cook's table describes the nature of the impact being loss of complex fungal, bacterial, plant, animal, ecological systems. Can you describe what you interpret that to mean?
I believe what Dr. Cook's referring to there is the interactions of soil and microbiota, as well as macrobiota and the plants within the soil to create a situation where the soil can purify water as it comes through, that uptake nutrients and toxins within the soil can provide habitat for microorganisms, as well as some of the larger organisms within the soil, as well as just provide a storage space where some of the water, as the precip falls on that, or that surface water run on comes on to the site, that within that organics, within the mineral soil and all of that, is that it holds water in place that would otherwise just flow off into the wetland that's down slope of it.
And are the depths of the soils relevant with respect to this concern?
Yeah, I mean, the deeper the soil, the more of this function that it can provide. Again, in most of the cases where I was using as an example, is that we recommend replacing 12 inches of soil in those locations. That seems to be successful in reestablishing plant communities as well as the functions there. If you're trying to do a bioremediation swale, that you're going to take direct discharge of stormwater and all of that and try to cleanse that, you probably want deeper, 18 to 24 inches of soil there. But, you know, soils as shallow as 8 inches can provide many of these same functions.
Do you agree with Dr. Cook's assessment about the timeline of the impact for slope wetlands?
Again, without any mitigation, she's absolutely correct that it would take hundreds of years to rebuild organics and within, subsoil that hasn't been exposed to any plant material or organics in, hundreds of years. It's going to take hundreds of years for it to develop, but with appropriate mitigation, is that those functions can be restored relatively quickly.
And if we could just scroll down a tab, please. Thank you. For the fifth factor, which is decreased soil permeability, do you agree with Dr. Cook's description about the nature of that impact to slope wetlands?
Yes, if you're decreasing soil permeability. But again, it's how much are you talking about decreasing soil permeability? If you're compacting it to 95%, then you're losing these functions. However, if the soil has been replaced there and somewhat compacted, is that while having less absorption, less interflow, less infiltration than might have been there, it doesn't mean that those functions are significantly altered in a way that negatively impacts the wetland that it's intended to protect. Again, decreasing the ability of the wetland of the buffer to absorb 100% of the water that comes through it doesn't mean that the wetland is going to be negatively impacted by that change in its absorption. And again, an impact that can be mitigated through that, even if a slope in the buffer has been compacted through vehicles driving over it, construction activities, storing of all that, doesn't mean that we can't go in and scarify that soil and thus increase its permeability once again to get it back to near where it was before the impacts occurred.
And do you agree with Dr. Cook's assessment about the timeline of those impacts for slope wetlands?
Yeah, again, yeah, it's if you do nothing, if you just impact the buffer and then walk away, then yes, it can take hundreds of years to accumulate organics. It takes a long time for soils to weather enough, particularly subsoils, so that they can accept water again. However, with the mitigation activities that I've described, is that these functions can be replaced relatively quickly.
And on to the sixth factor, which is removal of vegetation and replanting. Do you agree with Dr. Cook's description about the nature of that impact to slope wetlands?
Sure, is that if you remove the vegetation, you're going to have a temporal loss of the function that that vegetation was providing to that area. And replanting, clearly, you're going to have smaller plant material than what was there before. And so there is a temporal loss of that function, primarily of the habitat function, not so much of either the water quality or the hydrologic support functions that are provided. Reestablishment of the plantings, again, restores that function over time. Again, if you're losing, large trees, then it takes longer to restore that function. But again, nothing that can't be mitigated for over time.
And finally, for adjacent land uses, I believe it shows that it would impact all three of the functions that are identified up at the top. Do you agree with that assessment?
I'm not sure exactly what she means by that. Again, the adjacent land use is the adjacent land use. There might not be a change in that land use. So how that is impacting these things any differently is exactly the same as it was. In the case of what we're talking about here at Arborwood, they're talking about putting a road through the outer portion of a buffer. And that while there is some impact associated with that, it's not necessarily a loss of function to the point to be construed as any sort of a permanent impact. And that the you know, under current conditions out there, there's people out wandering around with their dogs and their, you know, I'm sure that there's house cats from the adjoining development that are already wandering around in this. It's not going to result in a significantly different level of effect on the buffer than what is currently there.
So you've described quite a few mitigation measures when you're talking about this table. Are you aware of whether any of those mitigation measures that you described have been incorporated into the Ecological Land Services Critical Areas reports?
I really don't know. It's been a long time, over a year, since I last looked at any of the mitigation plans that were prepared by ELS. I will say that all of the mitigation plans must be reviewed and approved by the county, and that all of these mitigation measures that I've talked about are fairly standard mitigation measures that are part of plans, and that if any one of those is missing or the county has a concern about that, the county would raise that prior to approving the mitigation plan.
I have no further questions.
Okay. Mr. Telligent, any questions of Mr. Wright?
Yeah. Good afternoon, Mr. Wright. It's good to see you again.
Good to see you.
I am, if you don't recall, the appellant's counsel. You and I met last year at the first Arborwood appeal hearing. I think I heard you say at the end of your testimony that putting the road in is not going to result in a significantly different impact than what is there right now. Did I hear you correctly?
Significantly different impact to the wetland.
And you said it's not going to.
I don't, in my best professional judgment, is that the placement of that road would not result in a significant impact to the wetland.
And when you are talking about a significant impact to wetland, are you also thinking about hydrological impacts?
Again, the hydrology impacts are addressed by the geotechnical engineers. I have been assured by them that the hydrology functions provided by that buffer will not be affected in any significant way.
I see. So let's step back a bit. So you were in the first Arborwood appeal, yes?
Yes.
And do you know how that appeal ended, what the result was?
I believe there was a remand.
Do you know what the directions were on remand?
I do not.
Okay. What do you know about the hydrology of the site right now? How is P2 recharged?
Again, I'm the wetland scientist. I'm not the hydrologist. I'm not the geotech person. Again, I delineated that wetland. I identified that it had wetland hydrology. How that hydrology was derived, I'm not even going to hazard a guess.
Wait, you delineated wetland P2?
Yep.
You personally did?
I delineated wetlands across that site. Whether or not I delineated P2 or P3 or any of those wetlands that are in that neighborhood, yes, I was on the site physically hanging flags.
Because in the last appeal, you had testified that Radicke misdelineated the P2 wetland, correct?
I don't recall what you're referring to.
You had testified that Radicke had delineated wetland P2 as a type 2 wetland on the mistaken view that it was part of a mosaic. Yes?
Again, delineation has nothing to do with the categorization of the wetland, other than identify the wetland, is that the classification of the wetland may have been done incorrectly. However, I don't believe the delineation was done incorrectly. And in fact, has been reviewed by Kitsap County, as well as the Department of Ecology, and verified as that is the location and extent of that wetland.
Fair point, sir. So you might have delineated, but you didn't rate the wetland.
Again, my company rated the wetland.
Okay. So your company rated the wetland. Do you know if the portion of the buffer around P2 that's being taken away plays any sort of special hydrological role in the recharge of wetland P2?
Again, I'm not the hydrologist.
Do you know the permeability of the fill material that they're putting in across that area?
I am not a roadway engineer. I don't pretend to have enough knowledge to testify on areas outside my areas of expertise.
So when you just testified that it is not going to result in a significantly different impact than what there is right now, you're just testifying as to what someone told you.
I am testifying that the loss of habitat functions from the diminishing buffer is not likely to result in a different score for the wetland. I am, for purposes of rating, I am assured that the hydrologic inputs to the wetland can be maintained and that the water quality functions, again, because we're providing over 100 feet of buffer on this, and that the water quality functions are all primarily contributed within 100 feet of the wetland, I see no point to say that there would be a diminishing of the ability of that buffer to provide water quality function.
How is it described to you that adequate hydrology would be provided?
That the design of the road, as well as the underlying hydrologic influences on the site, would continue to maintain that as a slope wetland. Slope wetlands are, as Dr. Cook testified earlier, are kind of interesting ones in
Wait,
the fact.
let's go. Can we go back to my
No,
question?
let me, like, well, sure.
I asked you. How was it explained to you that the hydrology to the wetland would be maintained? And maybe it wasn't explained to you, but was it explained to you? And if so, what was that explanation?
Again, I was informed that the hydrology would not be altered in a significant way as a result of the placement of that road.
Let's see here. You talked about a Snoqualmie Ridge project. Can you tell me a little bit more about that? Like, for example, what kind of wetland was involved in that one?
Slope wetlands.
Okay. And you talked about monitoring. Or actually, let's step back a bit. You talked about when you design the road, adequate
I didn't
hydrology.
design the road.
Okay, you talked about adequate hydrology was provided. Do you know how adequate hydrology was provided in that case?
Yes, is that a semi-permeable layer was included within the roadbed so that water that was moving subsurfacely from above the road, upslope of the road, could pass through and below the road prism and discharge into the upper portions of the slope wetland.
Okay, and were you told that the same would be done here?
It's my understanding that that is exactly the same technique that is intended for this road.
Okay. And you talked about there being performance standards in that case. What were the performance standards? Do you know?
Again, performance standards are on a case-by-case basis for the mitigation plans. What is the identified impact? What are you doing to rectify that? And what are the performance standards to ensure that those actions are in fact meeting the designed criteria?
And do you know what the performance standards were in that case?
The performance standards were for what? Their performance standards range everything from number of plants surviving to the diversity of plant material there, to water level fluctuations, to, again, it's not one performance standard. There's many performance standards. And again, those are determined by the review of the agency having jurisdiction.
Okay. Do you know what the performance standards were relating to wetland hydrology?
That there be no significant change in water level fluctuations within the wetland.
Very good. And then you talked about monitoring. How did you monitor that after that project was completed?
Again, that there were annual visits to the wetland to count plants to determine whether or not plants were successfully there. In some of these wetlands, there was establishment of staff gauges to determine and shallow groundwater monitoring wells to determine if the hydrology was different post-construction.
Okay. Do you know if the applicant is proposing like anything like that here or if the county is requiring it?
I do not know if they are in this case or not.
Okay. Do you have you ever done a literature review on sort of like not like sort of what the jurisdictions require, but a literature review on best available science on what kind of buffers slope wetlands need in order to maintain adequate hydrology.
I have read the documents that have been produced by others who have done those literature reviews.
And I think you said that a buffer as little as 16 feet can provide that.
Yes.
And do you know if that's true in this case, that a buffer of 16 feet on the east end of P2 could provide adequate hydrology?
Well, it's a moot point, is that the Kitsap County Code requires a minimum of a 100-foot buffer on this wetland.
Do you know if a 100-foot buffer is adequate on the east side of P2 in this case to provide adequate hydrology?
I believe that the code requires a 100-foot buffer, and that a 100-foot buffer is being applied. That, based on the Department of Ecology studies, is that water quality functions can be provided with a 100-foot buffer.
Well, so technically a 200-foot buffer is required, and they can reduce it to 100 feet if they can show there's not going to be an adverse effect. But
Again,
do
the
you know if
Department of
I do...
Ecology's statement is that water quality functions can be provided with a 100-foot wide buffer that has nothing to do with the required buffer on P2 under Kitsap County Code. The water quality function of wetland buffers can be provided with 100 feet.
And I'm not talking about water quality, sir. I'm talking about hydrology. Do you
Again,
know
there
if
are no standards for what the hydrology is. The literature review is completely sparse on how wide a buffer needs to be to provide hydrologic support. One can make the inference that if water quality is 100 feet, then hydrologic support might be a very similar number, as that if the water it beyond 100 feet isn't really reaching the wetland in any way to affect water quality, it's probably not reaching the wetland in any way to affect hydrologic support either.
So it would be your theory in this case that wetland P2 probably isn't being fed by any water more than 100 feet away.
No, absolutely not. I think that there's infiltration going on all over that site that's moving through the subsurface and probably filling into Wetland P2.
You talked about scarifying the soil afterwards. You know if they're proposing to do that in this case?
I do not know.
And you mentioned that a permanent impact re refers to a total loss of a function or a buffer.
Yes, the permanent loss is the total loss of function.
So, for example, if we were to reduce the hydrology to P2 by half forever, that wouldn't be a permanent loss in your mind.
Again, you're making a presumption that the hydrologic requirement of that wetland is 100% of the water that's reaching it today. And
Well,
50% reduction of that probably would be. However, there's no indication that there's going to be a 50% loss in the hydrology reaching that wetland, nor is there any evidence to indicate that a change in hydrology is going to be detrimental to that wetland.
how can you say there's no evidence when you also said you haven't reviewed any documents since the last appeal?
I've seen nobody present any evidence that they say that a change in hydrology can be detrimental, but I've seen nobody that say this change in hydrology will be detrimental.
But you haven't reviewed anything, right? You haven't reviewed anything since
I've
the last
listened to the
appeal.
testimony provided in this hearing the last 2 days.
And you've heard the testimony about how P2 is fed through the drainage swale east of wetland P2.
I did.
And that doesn't concern you that they're going to dam that with a road?
Again, I do not believe that that is the sole source of hydrology to that wetland.
And what is your basis for not believing is the sole source?
Again, my conversations with the hydrogeologists on the project.
Okay. Just one moment, sir.
don't think I have any more questions. Thank you so much.
Okay. Mr. Getches, anything? See if we can hear him this time.
No questions.
Oh, okay. All right. So back to you, Ms. Equies.
Thank you. Just a few. Mr. Wright, Mr. Telligent asked you a few questions about the Snoqualmie Ridge project. Do you recall the nature of the impact to the wetlands for that project?
Again, the overall project had direct wetland impacts, not dissimilar to this particular project, direct stream crossings in order for roadways to go through, some grading impacts that intruded into to wetlands, as well as, again, a large road system that went through the site, a very steeply sloped site that has, again, groundwater seeps that create slope wetlands and that... So yeah, not a dissimilar project to this Arborwood.
When you say direct impact to wetlands, what does that mean?
That means that there was a permanent loss of wetland as a result of filling as from road prism and grading on the site.
So filling the individual wetland itself?
Filling the individual wetlands themselves.
Okay, thank you. No further questions.
Okay, I think with that, we're done with your testimony, Mr. Wright. Thank you also for coming in on such short notice and giving us some very useful information. Really appreciate it. So, Ms. Cleus, is there anything else the applicants wanted to do today? Or
Nothing else today. We will be ready with Mr. Limbaris on Friday morning.
Okay. All right. I think that's it for today. Then we'll see you all on Friday morning at 9 o'clock a.m. Have a good day.
Thank you.